Gettysburg Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast. Conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more. With voices from around the corner and around the globe.
What is the key to the American Constitution? It's lived long, it's served us well. Do we really know why it works? I'm Jerry Christensen, and this is the Seminary Explores. We're glad to welcome Professor Kenneth Mott, Professor of Political Science at Gettysburg College, and author of The Supreme Court and the Living Constitution, to our microphones today so we can talk about what is the key to the Constitution. First of all, we don't read it much, do we? We talk about it a lot.
Oh, no. It's important not to read it. That way you can use it any way you want.
But there are parts of it that elude us even today. I always think about that heavy section on slavery, which showed that it was a human document and had to be a compromise.
Yes.
But then there are some brilliant, long-lasting, irretrievable truths.
Yes.
Somewhere in between there must be the key.
Yeah. You know, I think if I had to say what was the single most important factor in the longevity of our Constitution, I would argue that it is not in what the text says, but rather the opposite, in what the framers left unsaid. And I think that was the great genius of the Constitution. If you read the Constitution carefully, what you discover is there's an awful lot written about the institutions, that is, the Congress, the two houses, the court, the presidency. A heavy emphasis on structure, what those should look like, how they come into being, how they are perpetuated, and so forth. And there's a great deal written about process, how you make a law, how issues are resolved, and so forth, how people can become elected officials, and the like. But there is almost nothing, in fact, I'm going to argue that there is nothing, which addresses the question of what we should become as a nation. And that is what is left unsaid. In other words, nowhere in the Constitution does it say, this is our goal. It emphasizes things like process, as I said. Example, free exercise of religion. It doesn't tell us what to believe. Freedom of speech. It doesn't tell us what to say. Freedom of the press, and so on. All of these are in there, but these are all mechanical devices. And nowhere does it say, and this is what we want to become. Now, having said that, I would point out that there is one great exception, which I am fond of talking to my students about, because they can relate to this. These are college students. We talk about the 18th Amendment. The 18th Amendment was the Prohibition Amendment. All
right?
Now, think about this. The 18th Amendment said, we'll tell you what we want to become as a nation. We want to become a temperate nation. We want to be an alcohol-free nation. That is our goal. Okay? Well, 13 years later, we ratified the 21st Amendment, which said, basically, darn it, we are so thirsty. Let's get rid of that silly old 18th Amendment. And they did. The 21st Amendment repealed the 18th. So that one effort to try to define a goal for America failed after only 13 years.
Yeah, it's the exception that proves the rule.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's remarkable. And you look at things like the role of religion. Here we are on Seminary Explores. I probably shouldn't say it. But nowhere is God mentioned in the Constitution. Nowhere.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's known
so
our
we
Pledge
have
of
freedom of religion, yeah. but again, yeah. nowhere no. does it suggest to us what we should do yeah. as a religious people.
It was interesting while you mentioned that, and not in defense of anything, but there were established religions at the time of the Constitution.
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
then they had to be slowly dismantled.
Yeah, and hence the weasel word mm-hmm. in the First Amendment. The first command of mm-hmm. the First Amendment, as you know, is Congress shall make no law respecting mm-hmm. an establishment of religion. That word respecting is a weasel word, right?
right?
It doesn't say no law
mm-hmm.
Creating establishment. It doesn't say that. That would be too simple.
Yeah,
all right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It just says no law respecting, which can easily be interpreted as meaning the federal government promises not to interfere with existing church-state relations in the various states, which are being called upon, of course, to ratify the Bill of
That's
Rights.
That's true, wasn't it? Yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
And so
yeah.
it's one way of getting support, right?
right?
And you're absolutely right. There were some established religions in the states and others not.
Mm-hmm.
We had really three different traditions going, I think, religiously at the time of the ratification of the Constitution. One was establishment. Not a theocracy, not in the Puritan, Massachusetts Bay Colony. We're not talking about that. But establishment in the sense that, for example, England has mm-hmm. an established church. There mm-hmm. is something called the Church of England.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It doesn't mean that others can't exist and flourish and so on in competition. But we had that. We also had disestablishment. Following, say, Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson in Rhode Island. And then we had separation. We had a separationist impulse headed by people like Madison mm-hmm. and Jefferson,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Keep church and say, build the wall of separation.
Yeah. Yeah. Are there elements of the Constitution, obviously there are, that set it apart not from non-constitutional monarchies of states, that's pretty obvious, mm-hmm. but from other constitutions around the world that haven't worked so well? What makes ours so enduring, do you think? Is it the in addition to the ones you've already talked about?
Yeah. Well,
Some constitutions somewhere have been thrown out and repealed and started over, and you hear wars up and down the American continent, north and south, about let's diss this constitution and get another one.
I think there's a built-in institutional check and balance system.
Oh, yes.
For interpreting the Constitution. Now, there are lots of constitutional arrangements in other countries where basically whatever the legislature decides as it makes laws is de facto constitutional.
I got it.
All right.
Yeah.
Now, we have a legislature. It makes laws. It's supposed to check itself, all right? That is, our elected officials are sworn to uphold the Constitution, which suggests that they should not knowingly pass a law which would violate the Constitution. But we go a step further and we say, it might happen. And if it does, we have something called a Supreme Court, which has the authority to strike down that law as being unconstitutional, and it has actually struck down about 130 congressional statutes in American history, and many, many more state laws.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of them have been struck down. Now, here's an interesting side point, and that is that nowhere in the Constitution is the power to do that given to the Supreme Court of the United States.
Is that right?
We call it judicial review.
Uh-huh.
All right? That is the power of the Supreme Court to reach out and strike down the act of any other branch of government, federal, state, or local. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
There is not one word written about that in the Constitution. Now, having said that, Alexander Hamilton who has recently gained great fame.
Yes, as a rock star.
I actually tried to get a ticket to that show when I found out it cost $1,200, and they were sold out until next January. I said, well, I'll wait. But anyway, Hamilton wrote, he was one of the Federalist Papers authors, as you know, Hamilton, Madison, and Jay. Mm-hmm. And in Federalist Number 78, these are articles which are written basically to the people of the state of New York, urging them to vote to ratify mm-hmm. the Constitution. And he writes in Federalist 78 about what the Supreme Court will look like, what it should be doing. All right, this is sort of crystal ball gazing on his part. He's trying to explain this to the people of New York. And he says, he outlines the idea of judicial review. And he says, you know, it may happen that what the Constitution says and what Congress says or a legislative body says may not square. You may not be able to put them together. You either have to choose one or the other. Now, to make that choice, it falls or should fall to the court mm-hmm. because the court makes judgments. And the court, in this case, the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. is committed or should be committed to upholding, quote, the fundamental law over and above laws which are not fundamental. So he creates this wonderful fiction in Federalist 78. He says the fundamental law, which is the Constitution, mm-hmm. is fundamental because it represents, his words, the permanent will of the people. All the states ratify and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that's the embodiment of the permanent will of the people. Whereas, he says, the act of the legislative body, Congress, for mm-hmm. example, represents the whim of the people. In other words, this is secondary. These are our elective representatives mm-hmm. who are acting on a more or less day-to-day basis. And as they do so, they may be wrong. All right? Yeah. So if it comes to a clash between the Constitution and the act of a legislature, the Constitution wins.
I'm glad you got us onto this tack of permanent law. There is a comparable development in all human civilization, including in religions, of trying to determine what is fundamental, natural law of some kind, and what is positive law? What rules do we make that maybe change this week or that week? These guys like Hamilton, Jay, Madison especially, were really after what is critical, what is fundamental, and how do we develop a government on that basis?
Well, again, you know, it falls to John Marshall, one of our first chief, and he's the one who actually installs the idea of judicial review, right? Okay, Marbury versus Madison,
right,
where he actually strikes down uh-huh. an act of Congress, right?
Yeah.
And that's the first occasion.
Yeah. And they had to abide by it. Thank goodness the government didn't.
And it was a magnificent act of politics on his part, because what he did was to strike down an act of Congress which actually intended to give to the Supreme Court a power, a new power, which Marshall claimed it could not do. So he's, on the surface, he's denying himself power. But underneath that, he's giving up the battle, but he's winning the war by saying, yes, we, the court, have the authority to do that, to say what is constitutional and what isn't. And you know, it has been up to the court, for the most part, ever since, to dress up and change the dress of this skeleton which we call the Constitution. The Constitution talks about structure and process, but says very little about the day-to-day activities and what the Constitution means on a daily basis. What does it mean to say, for example, 14th Amendment, the equal protection of the laws? What on earth does that mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it falls to the Supreme Court to ultimately say, to tell us what it means.
Yeah,
right? Yeah. Fill in the blanks.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Now, the strict constitutionalism, then, if it does exist at all, how do we square that with questions that never came up to Mr. Madison or Mr. I mean, not in public life, but the use of pot, for example, or marriages between persons of the same sex.
Yeah.
It may have crossed their mind deep down, but they're not going to cover that in the Constitution.
Yeah.
How far do strict constitutionalists have to bend in order to make this Constitution work?
Well, I have a bias here.
I'm amazed.
And you know, from the title of the book that I mentioned to you, the Supreme Court and the living Constitution, the operative word there is living, which means that in my judgment, the Constitution is subject to constant change.
Yeah.
And it falls to the court through this process of judicial review, principally, to keep updating the Constitution, to keep it current. Otherwise, it would have died a long time ago, in my judgment. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, along come people like Ted Cruz and the late Antonin Scalia, in some cases, saying, well, you know, we are originalists. We believe that the Constitution ought to be interpreted as meaning and saying exactly what the framers intended it to mean back there in 1791. Right? Well, you can't do that, I think, for two reasons. One is that the Constitution itself doesn't address most of these issues. It simply is silent. And the other is change is too rapid.
That's
the short of it.
Yeah. So to what degree, continue your bias then. I think that was an astute observation, not necessarily a bias. It is just the way of life. The Constitution does change. Oh, and let me go back one step. There was one case in which the Constitution had to be changed itself, and that was on the question of slavery. And then you mentioned one where the Constitution was changed and then changed back again when we learned our lesson about temperance. But
that's
on the slavery one, we're not going to tamper the Constitution unless we have to, but it did have to be adjusted in one case.
Yeah,
on slavery.
Yeah, no question.
And that was a political compromise, and it was almost admitted that from the beginning.
Sure.
And there was also, you almost thought there was a sigh of relief when it was passed, and many of the people who wrote the Constitution thought, let's hope we get over this in a few years. And unfortunately,
We have never gotten over that issue. If there's one intractable political issue in America, it is race relations.
Mm-hmm.
No question about it.
The very thing that makes us a genius of a state.
In 1868 and thereabouts, right after the Civil War, we had the so-called Civil War Amendments, right? 13, 14, and 15. Mm-hmm. They all address the plight of former slaves and what to do about it. But again, the court has to fill in the blanks, you know? And so you get to things like Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896, which says separate but equal. As long as the facilities for the two races are essentially the same, you can separate the races and still not deny equal protection. Well, that goes on for another 60 years.
Yes.
We get to Brown versus the Board of Education.
Mm-hmm.
And that begins to change.
Yeah.
But boy, we're still fighting that fight.
It is a living court.
Yeah.
So the decision about who will become a Supreme Court justice then, in each case, is important.
Oh,
and
your
principle that we are becoming a more divided nation is also reflected in the struggle over that.
Absolutely. And here we are at 4-4.
Yeah. And the days when we had people who had a general consensus, not always, but general consensus is kind of behind us. We want someone who reflects our ideology right now, one way or another. It's not necessarily interpreting the Constitution as it really was. It's as we see the Constitution, that could be an ideology. What's the future? The document remains in place, thank goodness. No one is attempting to try to change the Constitution, per se. But the court is the key to its operation.
And I think the court politically, as a political institution, is right on the cusp of change. Whether it's going to swing left or right may very well depend upon this fall's elections.
Mm-hmm.
It could indeed.
Yeah. They're right when they say we're picking the Supreme Court justice.
We're at 4-4 right now, but we've got at least two justices who are in their 80s. Mm-hmm. They're not going to go on mm-hmm. forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My gosh, Jerry, they're older than we are. It's hard to imagine that.
I won't go there.
How could anybody be older than we are? But they are.
My friend, Professor Kenneth Mott, long-term friend, is our guest today. He is the author of, among other things, The Supreme Court and the Living Constitution. We've talked about the key to the Constitution. I'm Jerry Christensen for the Seminary Explorers. Thank you, and have a very good day.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explorers from historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of Gettysburg Seminary. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.